This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The PGA Tour is all systems go, and so is the new show, Early Wedge, on the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Sportsline experts Sia Nejad, Mike McClure, and Eric Cohen, alongside myself, Rick Gaiman, Patrick McDonald, and Jason Sobel. Five times per week, the Early Wedge provides the best information for DFS lineups, outright selections, and so much more. Follow and listen to Early Wedge in the Early Edge feed on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sports Radio 610 presents Payne and Pendergast.
And just like that, spring training is over. Feels like just yesterday, Seth, that you and I were arriving to West Palm Beach to watch the first week of games, and now, poof, like dandelion spores, here we are. The season is here.
It was a fun spring training for multiple reasons. Obviously, first and foremost, Cam Smith. Being able to see Cam Smith up close in person and watch his two home runs in his debut in an Astros uniform, that was a whole lot of fun. But then also, I mean, you parked yourself out in the heat, no hat on,
no,
your scalp exposed to the elements, like you'd been buried in the sand and left to die. Well, ants ate away at you. You stood like 20 feet away from Altuve as he made his spring training debut in left field. It was now. One of those things would end way more promising than the other. Cam Smith, as a rookie baseball player, very, very promising spring training. Jose Altuve as a left fielder, a little bit hit or miss. Yeah. we're not so sure. Literally miss.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Like he jumped up and missed the ball entirely and then missed the fact.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I forgot we were there for that game where he jumped up. We weren't there for the game that he jumped up and hit left field. Yeah,
no, the only game we were there for was the one that he didn't get a ball hit to him the entire time for six innings.
He ended up staying all six innings. It looked like he'd been planned to go maybe three, and he just stayed out there waiting for something to come out his way.
You knew it was over when after the sixth inning he just left through the bullpen instead of going back to the dugout.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, I'm heading straight to my locker. See you guys later.
And then most importantly, from the Astros' perspective, is I feel that we probably stoked their spring training ticket sales for next season by what you and I were having.
We were an infomercial for them.
We tried to take it in as fans as much as possible. I might have spent a total of like 27 minutes in the press box, mostly waiting around to see if the cafeteria was going to open. But I just went out and I ate and drank and talked to our listeners and everything.
Yeah, man.
But the Cam Smith story, obviously, first and foremost, is the one that's most relevant right now because it's not – saw somebody tweet out the old wannabe Hardo baseball guy. He said, only a fool takes spring training seriously. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm sorry, because you might say that, but every time I see anybody from the Astros organization talk about Cam Smith, it's basically some version of, did you see that, dude?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Well,
yeah.
The dumbest thing about that take is to paint every – by doing that, you're painting every single player in camp with the same brush. And the fact of the matter is – spring training does mean a lot for some of these guys. It does mean nothing for some of these guys as well.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it doesn't. For the veteran players who are established, it means very, very little.
Do I think Yordan Alvarez is going to hit 168 this year?
Right.
No,
right.
I don't. You know?
For the young guys, it certainly means a whole lot, especially when there's competitive situations. So, Cam Smith and then DiCenzo. DiCenzo has been the most under-discussed element of all of it, because DiCenzo's batted over 1,000 OPS. He showed versatility and be able to play in the infield and the outfield. And he's just got more time in professional baseball than Cam Smith does. So the DiCenzo deserves credit, too, for, I think, to judge by the way Espada talks about him, his put his best foot forward in spring training.
Yeah, so from all the news that we've heard, and the Astros themselves have reported as to who's been informed they're not going to be on the team. It seems like the pitching staff is pretty well set. They're going to have 13 pitchers, and the starting five, the rotation, is what it was coming into camp, which is Framber, Hunter Brown, Spencer Arrigetti, Ronel Blanco, and Hayden Wisniewski. You got McCullers kind of lingering over on the injured list here. We'll see what happens with him over the next month or so. But as far as the roster they break camp with, and then the bullpen is they've got essentially one spot left in an eight-man bullpen that it looks like Ryan Gusto might be the only guy left standing right now just based on injuries. Forrest Whitley's going to start the season on the injured list. Caleb Ort's going to start the season on the injured list. Both of those guys will probably be back on the big league club here at some point. So the pitching staff is pretty well set. It does get pretty interesting when it comes to the last few roster spots of the 13 everyday players. And I'll touch on some of the things that Chandler Rome had to say in his kind of notebook piece that he did this weekend. But the very first topic in here was Chaz McCormick's roster spot. He's a big topic, apparently. He still isn't hitting. He had a three-run homer on Friday. Apparently, he murdered it. But his numbers are not great. He's had the opportunity here to take the right field position by the throat. Like, he was the guy coming into spring training that I think they wanted to win this job. He's still got options left to go down to Sugar Land. That's a key in all this. So there is flexibility with him. They don't have to just outright waive him and then leave him exposed to some other team picking him up. They can send him to Sugar Land. But they're in such a weird position with their roster right now in that they've got guys playing out of position defensively. So Jake Myers is almost a necessity in center field because he might be playing in between two totally inexperienced corner outfielders.
Yeah.
But Jake Myers is an awful major league hitter. So you're talking about situations where there's probably going to be, ironically, you might be pinch hitting for your best defensive outfielder late in games and putting a lesser defensive player out there because you might need a hit to drive in a run. It's weird. So Chaz may be secure in his spot on this roster just based on the fact that he, along with Dubon, are options in center field for this team. His versatility. Yeah.
Dubon, I feel a little bit bad for because I feel like there might have been a moment of time for a few weeks where Dubon thought, oh boy, this is my chance this year. I'm just gonna get to play second base every day.
No.
Not have to move around all over the place like I'm couch surfing. But I think Altuve is gonna play second base a fair amount. I think Mauricio Dubon will play second base a fair amount, but Dubon's also gonna be in the outfield a good chunk.
Well, and Brendan Rodgers still might make the team. If we're to assume that Chaz McCormick has not secured a spot on this team, and maybe he has, there's basically six guys fighting for four spots on the roster: DiZenzo, Cam Smith, Chaz McCormick, Hummel, Brendan Rodgers, and Zach Short.
And I don't think that's the part with DiZenzo and Cam Smith. I think that Dana Brown individually wouldn't have an issue with having either of those guys on the opening day roster, but having two guys that are rookies that you're not quite sure about yet and one of them playing right field, You end up with this logjam of, all right, they're young guys. They need everyday at-bats. They need to play every day. How do we go about that? And, well, we're also depending on a couple of unproven – we need one of these unproven guys to be the guy.
Yeah.
Well, the other guy isn't playing as much as we'd like him to.
Yeah. I think if Cam Smith as an Astro did not exist, if he was still a Cub –
yeah.
Now, obviously, Kyle Tucker would be here, and he'd be the right fielder. But let's pretend.
Let's say Kyle Tucker has a nondescript injury that we don't know about.
Something like that. Like, I think if there was no Cam Smith, I think Zach DiZenzo is your starting right fielder on Thursday night. He's been that good in spring training, and he's been a guy who's been up with the big league team before. This is not complete, and he spent plenty of time in the minor leagues. There's plenty of seasoning on Zach DiZenzo, but yeah, you can't have both. All of these guys need to, like, both of those guys, Cam Smith and Zach DiZenzo, need to play.
I think ultimately conventional baseball logic wins out. My guess, it's a complete guess, would be that Cam Smith starts the season in AA.
Yeah.
And that DiZenzo with more time in professional baseball ends up being on the roster, and they just want Cam Smith to continue to get everyday reps, more reps in right field, everything else.
I think deep down they want Cam Smith to be there, but DiZenzo's performance might be what saves them from making what could be a bad decision with Cam Smith to bring him up this early. He's played five games at double A.
DiZenzo gives you that comfort zone of saying, all right, we don't have to be, I guess we don't need to let our enthusiasm potentially make us make a bad decision. Because, you know, good GMs are always concerned about their own blind spots and everything. And every time he thinks about, like, yeah, boy, Cam Smith looks like he's ready to go, there's probably a part of him that says, all right, don't rush this. Just be careful. And DeZenzo, as well as he's played, gives you the elbow room to be able to do that,
yep.
I think.
Other things that Chandler has in his piece here from this weekend in The Athletic, Jose Altuve, Seth, has been getting tips from Yordan Alvarez on how to alleviate the drop seas out there. So he basically was telling Altuve that he needs to hold his glove higher. Instead, he's letting the ball come to him a little bit. He was giving him just little tips here and there. Yordan is not a great defensive left fielder, but he's serviceable. He's not bad. He's technically sound out there. You know, he's just
the whole thing about, well, now Yordan in a lot of ways can be a better asset to Altuve than a lot of people that have played the position in their entire lives, because if it's all those little things that the veterans don't really think about because they're so ingrained in them that they don't have to think about it, Yordan has experience thinking about it more because he's had to consciously make the transformation. That's what I think. There's times I used to think about this in football, that there would be times where sometimes players would be better served by a Pop Warner coach than a veteran, because you get to the NFL and for the most part, I dealt with this when I was done playing, and I would go down and help out with youth and high school kids and everything. I was like, I'll be honest, I don't know how to coach somebody to get into a 3-point stance. Yeah. Like from the very, I can tweak their stances just fine, but actually starting from the very basics of how to get into a 3-point stance, I don't have a clue. So Yordan has thought about this stuff more consciously than a lot of other guys.
That's the terrifying thing to me, is that our manager proclaimed everyday left fielder, Joe Spada, has said Jose Altuve is going to play most of the season out in left field, is getting what feels like, to your point, like little league tips on how to play the position. And opening day for MLB is Thursday. Like, this is like showing a dude how to work a stick shift as they're throwing him into the cockpit to drive in the Daytona 500. Like,
Wait, you mean I got to drive with both feet?
Clutch?
What?
Left foot clutch. Let her up easy.
Usually my left foot's just hanging out there, wedged up against the side.
Yeah. Sometimes as I'm driving by the beach, yeah.
I was told specifically not to drive with both feet. Yeah. It's a bad thing.
I'm reading that section of Chandler's article. Well, I'm like, well, this is kind of scary.
Well, this is a thing, too, to remember, too. I get the same thing happens in the draft talk with football players. I really hate when anybody ever uses the term a simple fix. Oh, that's a simple fix. Oh, well, Altuve, when he's had these issues dropping the ball these last couple times, it's when he was going to have to make a throw home. So he's just got to break it down and do it more simply. Listen, yes, sometimes a simple fix ends up looking like Bagwell's stance. You know, like, it's not always so simple to fix something. Right. It's just, which obviously Bagwell's stance worked out magnificently for him. He's a Hall of Famer. But it's not always so simple to make the simple fix, no matter how good you are at something.
Right.
So the simple fix at the highest level of the sport, where all these other guys are at various times struggling with simple fixes, it's just never that simple.
No.
It's never as simple as a simple fix.
No.
Or at least it often isn't as simple as a simple fix.
No. So the next thing Chandler has in here, so we're just going through some of the Astros' late spring training scuttlebutt. Chaz McCormick's roster spot, big topic. Jose Altuve working hard to try to become a serviceable left fielder, getting tips from another serviceable left fielder, Yordan Alvarez. This one, not a big surprise. No extension offer for Framber Valdez this spring. Like, not even any conversation, which I guess jives with Dana Brown getting asked. I forget if it was a press conference or an interview that he did. Like, so have you guys talked about an extension, you guys and Fromber? And Dana Brown's like, yeah, you know, like in the last couple of years we've talked about it. And then I'm like, as a parenthetical question afterwards, like, how long have you been with the team, Dana? 2 years. Yeah. Like, so at some
well,
point,
that's
since
where,
he became
when
GM.
When Adam Spillane had his sit down with him.
Yeah. Well, that's what it was.
Yeah, it was Adam Spillane sit down. He said we've had talks with him
the last couple
and
years.
And then Adam Spillane said, but not recently. And Dana Brown confirmed, no, not recently.
That's what it was.
So Framber's going to make a lot of money as a free agent if he stays healthy.
If he stays healthy. Because I think he's reached a stage now where you can almost pencil him in for what his, you know, he's going to win somewhere between 13 and 15 games. Yeah. His ERA will be somewhere in the high twos and low threes. He'll strike out plenty of guys for a guy who's a ground ball pitcher. And he'll and the big thing is he'll go throw 200 innings for you.
Right. And yeah, he'll just grind innings. I think that probably the least heralded part of Framber's game, but that baseball people around the league look at and admire is, man, when we get into a crunch with our relievers or we've got health issues or whatever, I can just throw this guy out here and he's just going to go six or seven innings day after day after day. That's a really nice luxury to have. I think, and I think he's going to get, because of that, because of some of the gutsier stuff, I think he'll get more money than a lot of the baseball savant type people think he's going to.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that he's got really good numbers otherwise, he's just a workhorse. And the other part, this is where the Astros hurt. I don't want to say it hurts them. They're so good at developing pitchers, but then guys like Charlie Morton or Gerrit Cole or otherwise, they leave the Astros pitching Shangri-La and they continue to be good pitchers. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they fall to dust after they leave the system or the scheme. I think there's a certain level of assurance that other teams have that, okay, yeah, this guy's going to remain the same guy.
Here's a quick paragraph from Chandler's piece. This is Chandler Rome's kind of notebook column that he did on the Astros this weekend, all the various news nuggets about them. The presence of budding ace Hunter Brown might have mitigated the need to extend Framber Valdez. So did the looming return of Javier from Tommy John surgery, though the team's apparent inability to rehab injured pitchers in a timely manner must be taken under consideration. And that's true. And that's something I brought that up on Friday when we were talking about. Oh, we were probably talking about Luis Garcia getting shut down. Luis Garcia was supposed to throw a live BP on Thursday, and for like the third time in his rehab has been shut down. I don't follow other teams rehabbing Tommy John patients closely enough to know if this is an Astros issue or a Tommy John surgery or elbow issue. But it is always interesting to me when people bring up the returns of guys like McCullers and Garcia and Javier, and while he was still here, he's not here anymore, or Urquidy, guys like that, as if it is some sort of solid timeline where there's a definitive return date, given how jagged the returns have been for some of these guys.
Right, and that's where I just don't know. And I try to read everything Chandler writes because he's very good. But I don't remember seeing actual stats of the Astros' recovery times of pitchers compared to other teams.
I would love to see that.
He's probably done it at some point. I would reach out to him and ask him, but I'm pretty sure he hates us. So, which is fine because I pay him $8 a month to do this work for me and give it to me.
Yeah.
He's kind of like an extra producer we have on our show.
Oh,
he gives such good content.
Yeah,
but much like many of our producers, I feel like he hates us.
Yeah, right. Like, Ben? Shut up.
You won't mention our station by name?
Attribution, please. All right, so those are some of the things going on with Astros spring training. It'll be here Thursday, man. Thursday opening up against the Mets. Framber on the mound. It'll be good. All right, let's get to acknowledging some folks from the weekend. We do it every Monday at about this time. The little segment is called Acknowledge Me. I will say a name of somebody who is worth acknowledging, either through performance from the weekend or they need to be highlighted for some other reason. This is the time to do it. I'll say a name. Ben Gary, our producer, will give us the Roman Reigns hotkey.
Acknowledge me!
We will acknowledge them. Let's start with somebody we acknowledged briefly in headlines, but I feel like we need a little more runway, a little more leeway to acknowledge just what a remarkable, remarkable career this person and life this person had. George Foreman.
Acknowledge me.
Oh, man, come on.
Acknowledge me.
Ben. Yeah. Give it to him one more time, Ben.
Acknowledge me.
What's going on with the hotkey in there?
The man's out to get us.
Yeah. Yeah, someone's got it
in
for George Foreman.
To acknowledge George Foreman.
George Foreman passes away this weekend at the age of 76. And, man, you go back and read a bio on George Foreman, like, if it hasn't happened already, we need a 30-for-30 style doc on George Foreman.
There's a bunch of them out there. And one thing that popped up on Netflix yesterday was something that was already out there, but it was The Rumble in the Jungle, a documentary about The Rumble in the Jungle in 1974.
Yep.
And that's when he lost his title to Muhammad Ali. Mm-hmm. That I'm going to watch that at some point in the next couple days. I think the biggest thing for younger people that didn't know George Foreman, probably the most remarkable thing that they would be surprised about is that he was a two-time heavyweight champion. The first when he was 21 years old. The second when he was 45 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
It was one of the most incredible and unlikely comebacks ever. And it was really cool to watch. I was old enough to pay attention to the 45-year-old championship. But I think the other thing, too, about Foreman that I didn't appreciate that people older than us would is, like, this is a guy, if you think about just kind of growing and maturing in ways that a lot of people will tell you you can't. Like, this is a guy who was, he was an angry dude when he was a young boxer. And, like, it was him versus the world in a lot of ways. And over the course of 20 years, he became almost this lovable grandfather type. He kind of smoothed out all of his rough edges, and yet was still a vicious enough fighter to be the heavyweight champion at the age of 45. And then went on to probably have one of the most successful infomercial products of all time, the George Foreman grill, based on partly his lovable grandfatherly demeanor that he had at that time.
No doubt. And honestly, for the really younger part of our audience, they may know more about the George Foreman grill than they do the Rumble in the Jungle, probably.
Yeah.
You know, but that's, you know, the way I look at it, I didn't realize his career record was 76-5 as a professional boxer. He was 76-5 with 68 knockouts. So practically nearly 90% of those wins came from knocking the other guy out. And that pales in comparison to his career as an entrepreneur. You know what I mean? Like, he was 70. He was 76. And think about this. He was an Olympic gold medalist. He beat Joe Frazier in a legendary fight. You know, the down goes Frazier. That Howard Cosell call was from that fight. The Rumble in the Jungle has had documentaries, as Seth points out, made about it. Came back and won the heavyweight title 20-plus years later. 76-5 for his career. And yet, the fact that he sold 100 million George Foreman grills and sold the rights to it for $137.5 million to me, that to me is more remarkable than the boxing career.
It flipped on its head all of the sad stories of heavyweight boxers who lose their fortune or whatever, and end up struggling, not to mention some of the mental issues that they end up having, or the mental degeneration.
Yeah.
He really thrived more and more as a human being as he aged, and had named all of his children
all his kids named George. I think, like, the same middle name, too. Like, they all have the same government name.
He was an incredibly unique individual in American sports history. Like, in a way that nobody else is like George Foreman.
Yeah.
Or was like George Foreman, or lived the life that he had. It was really incredible.
Did you say When We Were Kings, the name of that documentary about the Rumble in the Jungle, or no? I'm only saying that because the texter is... In case people want to seek it out, the name of it is When We Were Kings.
There's a newer one. I think there's a newer one.
Okay.
I don't know. Just go search on Netflix.
Yeah. So RIP George Foreman, a great Houstonian as well. I mean, we didn't mention that. Like, from here, a big cheerleader and a Houston Sports Hall of Famer as well, George Foreman. All right, let's acknowledge the Cougs.
Acknowledge me.
Six straight Sweet 16s. They beat Gonzaga. I thought they got dealt the toughest of the 8-9. Winners, and they handled it. They handled it great. The game was not as the final score was not an indicator of how different the Cougs looked than Gonzaga in that game. They were like the Cougs were a cut above Gonzaga throughout that entire game.
Gonzaga made a push at the end, but it wasn't anything where you ever felt like, oh boy, the Cougs weren't ready for action or anything. They've come into this tournament looking exactly the way you hope they would, where I don't think there was any kind of... I think it's maybe one of the advantages of having a culture that they do at University of Houston, having been to this many straight Sweet 16s, that the young guys know all the pitfalls and everything. And obviously, Kelvin Sampson has dealt with some of the teams that have had scares or disappointing performances early in the round. They haven't looked anything like that so far.
No. And they can score a little bit, I think, more than Cougs teams that have come into the tournament in seasons past. You know, that LJ Cryer and Emmanuel Sharp, like this team can shoot it a little bit. So I think that's to me has always been the reason I've never picked the Cougs to win the whole thing, is just they've been so capable of having a complete stinker offensively. It doesn't matter how good you are defensively if you have some of the games they've had. But I think this team is maybe a notch above the other ones Kelvin Sampson's brought into the tournament offensively. So we'll see how it goes. They play Purdue on Friday night for the right to move on to the Elite Eight. Over bettors, bettors taking over 151.5 in the UConn versus Florida game. Take a listen to the last 5 seconds of this one.
77-72 Florida. 3 seconds, 2 seconds, McNeely fires it. A three at the horn, and it's over. Florida survives 77-75.
Okay. Acknowledge me.
Yeah, we'll acknowledge the over bettors. Yeah, they, so that was there. There's been a I would say among the complaints about the first weekend of the tournament, Seth, until Maryland beat Colorado State yesterday on a buzzer beater, there's been a severe lack of any drama at the end of most of these games. There have been some close games, but there haven't been really. There's been hardly any games where a team's got the ball with a chance to win it at the end, and they either do or don't. They, you know, these games have lacked that. But if you're a degenerate gambler, that was a serious buzzer beater right there. 77-72. The over-under is 151.5, and Liam McNeely from UConn pulls up from 30 for a meaningless three on the scoreboard. And I turned to Amy as soon as he made that. I'm like, man, somebody – and I didn't know what the total was on the game, but I'm like, somebody got screwed on that one. And I texted a buddy who texted me back. Oh, it was my son, James, who is a buddy of mine, but he's my son as well. He was out with some friends who had under 151.5, and he was laughing his ass off. Like, that three went in. He's like, oh, yeah, a couple of my buddies are so mad at the bar right now. So that's the madness of March that I like, the ones that maybe seem invisible to the average fan. But yeah, to the degenerate gambler fan, you go, oh, yeah, that got that's, so, yeah, that's what I'd be in a sports book for.
I've come to appreciate this. This is one of the things that I realized over the course of the last few years watching Texans games next to you, especially in 2021 and 2022 when it was just dark days, was how much excitement there can be in the fourth quarter of a game. Yes. if there's action. Yeah, if it's affecting somebody. I get it now. That's the first thing that made me really get it and understand where if you've got a responsible gambling, let's say recreational activities, that you're, keeps you really engaged in even crap games,
yeah,
by crap teams.
Yeah, man. Sometimes you need that to muscle your way through a bad season. But it's, man, being in a sports book, Amy and I are going to the Golden Nugget this weekend for the Sweet 16 and the Elite
Eight.
Oh,
so you're going to be able to watch from the sports book?
Yeah. So I can see all the reactions to meaningless baskets like that one at the end of games. Highly entertaining. Dan,
have you ever seen like a tantrum or a flip out?
Oh yeah,
at the end of a sports book.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, all the time, all over the place. Yeah. Like anybody, like just throw a glass against the floor or anything like
I've
that.
I've seen things thrown. Yeah.
Really?
Man, people. There's a lot of desperate people in those sports books.
Yeah,
you know. Dan Friedkin.
Acknowledge me.
You may not know the name. He's the CEO of the Friedkin Group, a locally based company here. They're the owner of Gulf States Toyota. This is a story from late last week, but it's worth, I figure this is a good segment to put it into here. He, Seth, has emerged as a strong ownership option to bring the NHL to Houston. I feel like we're getting warmer here and getting the NHL to Houston. Now, well, especially now that it's not just Tillman Fertitta that might bring it here.
It's tough, though, because, I mean, the best opportunity in terms of the way things were working with the league was when Phoenix was going to move.
Yeah.
And the problem is that the NHL has 32 teams now, and the commissioner himself has said, we haven't even brought up the word expansion in any of our meetings as of late, that the math and the actual reports from the NHL itself seems like they're not creating any new teams anytime soon.
Yeah.
So now are we like vultures kind of looking around to see where the best candidate for relocation is?
I guess. Yeah, if we want a team, we probably have to. The other cities that are on the expansion radar, Atlanta, which kills me because they've lost the NHL twice in that city.
Yeah.
Like the Flames moved to Calgary. And then whatever, the Thrashers became the next version of the Winnipeg Jets.
You might as well go marry Liza Minnelli or something.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not going to work out well, all
nope.
right?
Nope. Omaha. God, if we lose an expansion bid to Omaha, then we deserve whatever we get. Kansas City, Cincinnati, New Orleans. Those are the... I mean, we're into... It's Houston, and then all these sort of tier two... I'm saying tier two from a population and a media presence standpoint. Like, Houston is so far out in front of all these cities. I You're right.
If Omaha gets an NHL team, I blame Oklahoma City for getting an NBA team. Because they'll see, oh, wow, when you're the only show in town and you're an event, there you go. The other thing about Omaha, too, is that they've shown the sports like volleyball have done so incredibly well there that they just get this massive interest in a sport that isn't a traditionally, you know, high-profile sport damn it.
So, fingers crossed. I would love, if it's not Tillman Fertitta getting the NHL, that'll be interesting to see how that works out with Toyota Center being the only place to really play right now, an NHL team. So, but we'll see. To your point, we're probably a ways off, but at least it's on the radar. So, Dan Friedkin, CEO of the Friedkin Group. Lily Stewart.
Acknowledge me.
You may not know who she is, but you might have seen her mugshot over the last week. Have you seen this mugshot, Seth, of this?
Only because you sent it to me.
The Georgia co-ed, who's, I believe, 20 years old. She went viral back on March 8th. She had and she's very pretty. She had a smiling mugshot after getting arrested. She was going to a party in Milledgeville, Georgia, back on March the 8th. And she was given a speeding ticket for going 85 in a 55. So the cop gives her the ticket. She pulls out, you know, pulls off, starts leaving again. Immediately starts going 85 in a 55. Gets pulled over
immediately
again, yes, for doing the same speed. And so at that point, they arrested her and brought her in for some form of reckless driving. 2 weeks later, arrested again for obstruction. This sounds a little more shady. Obstruction of a law enforcement officer and loitering/prowling. So who knows what that is, if she was lurking in the weeds outside somewhere.
Loitering/prowling.
So she may have a...
Loitering sounds like... boy, you add prowling to the mix, and boy, this young woman's going to make some young man very, very miserable someday.
Very happy at some points, but very miserable at most points.
Very happy, like, while he still deludes himself that it's going to be awesome. Because look at how pretty. And she's so vivacious.
Yeah.
She's got a lot of life to her.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So, boy, but also, a little bit of respect. It sounds like she just peeled out. Coming up, like the officer went back into his car and she just peeled out and said, "No, I'm going to do it again."
When's the last time you got a speeding ticket? Or have you ever gotten a speeding ticket?
I've had a bunch of them.
Yeah.
It's been a long time.
Yeah.
It's been a long time.
Yeah. It's been a while for me. To the last time I got one, I don't know, probably like, I got one on Amy and I on our road trip 2 or 3 years ago. It's a miracle I've only gotten one on these road trips that we go on. We drive like 3,000 miles every summer.
I've gotten out of a lot of... I had a stretch where Brandy was like growing increasingly disgusted with me because I was so good at getting out of speeding tickets.
Oh, yeah?
Now, some of them were like, all right, I got pulled over in Houston. The cop may or may not have recognized me.
Yeah.
so some of them are that variety. The ones I'm most proud of were the ones where I was completely anonymous in a place and just by virtue of being congenial. Yeah. These are the keys. Pull over as far as humanly possible to the side of the road, okay? Don't be one of these jamokes that pulls into the median or something.
Right.
Because then the cop is under stress to begin with.
Yep.
And then now he's under stress of getting hit by another vehicle
or something. Good advice,
yep. So pull over like to the point where you might not be able to get yourself off the side of the road because you're so far into the grass. Open up all your windows. Have your hands at 10 and 2, and whatever you do, don't deny that you were speeding. This cop is not judging you.
No.
He's not saying you're a bad person because you were speeding. He's just doing his job. And if you own up to it, and then this is the hard part, though. You got to try to make, like it is when the other social situation, try to make friends with the person.
Yes.
As quickly as possible without looking like you're trying to suck up to him or something.
That's good advice. Yeah. Let me ask you this. When you've got, because I'm with you. I've gotten probably literally like dozens of speeding tickets in my life. I've gotten better.
Well, I haven't gotten dozens, but okay. Yeah.
I've probably gotten.
Seth, I'm just like you. I've killed a hobo or three.
No. Yeah. I think I've gotten, like, when I say dozens, I mean two. That's, you know, plural.
Okay,
I don't mean like 45 or anything. But yeah, like I've gotten more than I care to admit. But I've only gotten a couple like in the last 10 or 15 years. This is my question. How long do you drive around the speed limit for after getting the ticket? Like, how long until you start actually, like, you know, going a comfortable amount over the speed limit? Is it while the cop is still in your rear view? Or do you actually take that ticket as a true warning or a true punishment and slow down for a bit? Or are you more like Lily Stewart, who basically punches the gas the second she gets the ticket handed to her?
No, I for sure on that same trip, I'd be super careful for a while. I don't know. Yeah, it's been a long time. I've been somebody that, like, I don't usually go more than 5 miles per hour over the speed limit, hardly ever anymore.
Mm.
Just because I realize how much extra stress it adds to try to get to a place, like, 15 minutes early. Not to mention danger.
Yeah.
I got middle-aged, I guess. I was like, what's the hurry, man? Yeah. I'm just going to listen to a podcast.
Yeah.
You know, it's Sunday. Sean's on his national show. I'll listen to him via the Odyssey app.
It's very pleasant.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to be clear, when I said dozens, I meant two dozen. For you cops out there, you happen to know what I drive. I'm a very safe driver, all right? That was in my younger years where I was in a hurry to get to places and realized what kind of folly that is.
Stupid. You know what helps now is that I kind of... Now that I've got the smart, whatever it's called with the cruise, the smart cruise control, where it just keeps the distance behind you and everything, it's nice to just I set the speed and I sit in the right lane and I kind of just stop paying attention to how fast I'm going.
Yeah.
And it's much, much safer that way until, like, every now and then I'll be like, I'm stuck behind somebody really slow.
Yeah,
but it almost feels like I'm being chauffeured around by the conscious version of myself as I drift off into unconsciousness.
That's a good advertisement for that feature right there.
Yeah.
All right. Payne and Pendergast, that's acknowledge me. We acknowledge big stuff from over the weekend and the last week. Mock draft injection time. Easy grader Chad Reuter has a 4-round mock. Chad Reuter is the one who gives report cards to teams and doesn't give anything below like a B-. Let's see what he has the Texans doing in this upcoming draft. A 4-round mock for our mock draft injection for the day on a Monday. Stay there.
I'll give you a little quick tip too, also, just as far as, because I've had incredible success with getting airline employees to do incredible things for me, like when I'm in a really position of distress. I cannot stress this enough to people. Just like, you know, the cop isn't judging you for how fast you were going unless it was crazy or whatever. The airline employees genuinely do want to help you. What they don't want is a foaming at the mouth version of a person that demands that you help them. If you just explain your situation without blaming that individual that's standing in front of you, it is incredible how far they'll go.
They'll help.
Because they just dealt with 10 people that were being jerks to them. That just explain the severity of your situation, but they'll help you.